1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 6. We've read it already. We've quoted it together. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices in the truth. That's the verse I've been asked to speak on tonight, and happy to do so. The Living Bible translates it slightly differently. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. It is never glad about injustice, but rejoices whenever truth wins out. The King James Bible, good news for medieval man, says, I say that tongue in cheek, it is a great translation, of course, that has stood the test of time. Rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. The Message, a modern paraphrase, puts it this way. It does not keep an account of evil or gloat over the wickedness of other people. On the contrary, it is glad with all good men when truth prevails. If you want the Curley translation, not available for publication just yet, but the Curley translation of the verse would say this: love does not delight in wrongdoing, but in right doing. Love does not delight in wrongdoing, but in right doing. I grew up in the Midlands. Coventry is where I was born and bred. I did for a year when I was training alongside two evangelists move, I suppose, about 10 or 15 miles down the road to Royal Leamington Spa. And I spent 6 months in Royal Leamington Spa and 6 months in Warwick living and training alongside two evangelists. If you go to Leamington Spa, like all cities, there are graveyards. In fact, there was a man, I've forgotten his name, in the assembly at Priory Terrace Leamington Spa, who used to do a whole evening on graveyard photos he'd taken of tombstones. Some of them were funny, some of them were insightful. But it was quite interesting if he gave you a little tour around the graveyards of Leamington Spa. But there is a tomb in Leamington Spa, or tombstone, and it says this, engraved on the tombstone: here lies a miser who lived for himself and cared for nothing but gathering wealth. Now where he is or how he fares, nobody knows and nobody cares. In contrast, if you go to St. Paul's Cathedral, London, there is a plain tombstone that reads with these words: sacred to the memory of General Charles George Gordon, who at all times and everywhere gave his strength to the weak, his substance to the poor, his sympathy to the suffering, his heart to God. What a contrast between two tombstones, two epitaphs, two opposites. One life, selfless lovingness. One, selfishness. Chapter 13, of course, of 1 Corinthians is a passage on love, on caring, on compassion. And the good thing about this passage is it's not theoretical, it's practical. I preached in a church this morning and a man came up at the end of the service. He said, thank you for that. He said, we've just had so much theology the past few weeks. It's nice to get something that we can actually apply to our lives. And of course, we need both. We need both, don't we? A balance of teaching, so that we know what we believe and who we've believed in, but we know how to work out or outwork our faith, outwork our doctrine in everyday living. And this, of course, is a very practical chapter. It is not a lecture. It is a sermon. There's a difference between lecturing and preaching, isn't there? Lecturing is what someone gives to students. It's the passing on of information. Tongue in cheek, someone described a lecture this way: the art of transferring information from the notes of the lecturer to the notes of the lecturees without passing through the minds of either. Well, that may be a lecture, but it's not what we're doing this evening. It's not preaching, is it? I like how Alistair Begg describes preaching. The preacher's task is to declare what God has said, explain the meaning, and establish the implications so that no one will mistake its relevance. We declare something with authority. We explain it so that folks can understand it. And then we relate it to our lives. How are we going to apply this? Because consequences follow. We're not to be hearers of the word, we're to be doers of the word. Henry Drummond, in his classic book entitled The Greatest Thing in the World, based on 1 Corinthians 13, compares verses 4 to 7 of this chapter to light passing through a prism and being separated out into its various colours. And just as the various colours of the spectrum all work together to make white light, so the Apostle Paul describes love in its component parts, a rainbow of actions that all work together to show God's love. And I love this chapter because it's so practical. In the Greek text, there are 15 verbs. Our English translations change some of the verbs to adjectives. But in the Greek, they're all verbs. They're all doing. They're all action commands, action words. And that's significant because we're not in a lecture. If you just go away with information, I failed as a preacher. The challenge is, what am I going to do with what I've read? How am I going to apply it into my life, into my situation when I leave this building? Let me remind you of the framework of the verses, just as we break down verse 6. There are three sections to this chapter. First of all, love is described positively. What love is? That's verse 4. Love is patient, love is kind. So first of all, what love is? Secondly, love is described negatively. What love is not? That's verses 4b to 5. Love does not envy, does not boast, is not proud, is not rude, is not self-seeking, is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Thirdly, love is described with a contrasting statement. That's verse 6, and that's our verse for tonight. A contrasting statement. Love does not delight in evil. And the contrast, it rejoices with the truth. And then fourthly, you have four things love always does. And that's verse 7. And that's your topic for next week. Always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. And we're looking at that middle section, verse 6. That contrasting statement. And it divides in two, so you get a two-point sermon. You wish. Let's look at them. First of all, be displeased about the wrong things. Be displeased about the wrong things. One of the problems with this chapter is this. It gets divorced from the rest of the book, the rest of the letter. It's such fantastic poetry that it stands alone. And it is often read alone and quoted alone. The last wedding night I was fortunately to be speaker at, it was read in the service. And it's a favourite at wedding ceremonies because it's an occasion to celebrate the love of two individuals. And this verse expresses what love is. But we forget it wasn't written to be put into wedding ceremonies. It was written quite deliberately and sandwiched quite deliberately between chapter 12 and chapter 14 to cement the two together. One of the blessings and one of the problems we have with the Bible is this, that someone very helpfully divided the Bible up into chapters, Archbishop Stephen Langton in 1228 BC. And chapters first appeared in the Latin Vulgate Bible. You don't believe that?
BC, no.
No, he added the verses. He added the verses in 1503. But Archbishop Stephen Langton divided the chapters. And then Robert Einstein, Estienne, a printer living in Paris, added the verses. And the verses first appeared in the Geneva Bible, the Bible of someone like John Bunyan. Now, if you think I'm wrong, you Google it. If you come up with someone different, I'm happy to be corrected. But from my research, that's the information I've got. And those chapter divisions and verse divisions are great. It means out of a Bible of 66 books, you can focus in instantly on that one phrase, just by giving you an address, a reference. The problem is, of course, it wasn't always divided correctly. Classic example is Isaiah chapter 53. Doesn't start at verse 1, that servant song. You have to go to the end of chapter 52. And you get to chapter 52 and verse 13, and that starts the whole new section. So chapters often divide the Bible up wrongly. And one of the dangers is we pull odd phrases and odd portions out of context. And I believe in many ways that's what's happened here with chapter 13. When we divorce it from the rest of the book, we don't fully understand what it's saying. Now, I've said all of that because when I sat down, I had one interpretation of applying this verse to our lives. And having studied it, I come up with a totally different appreciation of it. Partly due to Warren Wiersbe. Some of you might know the writings of Warren Wiersbe. He's a very good Bible commentator. And he points out in his commentary that every one of these sayings in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, you can apply to a problem that was going on in the church at Corinth. And in his commentary, he does exactly that. He says, love is kind relates to this. Love is patient relates to that. Love isn't jealous relates to that. And it's quite insightful. And I sat down and looked at this verse and thought, yeah, this verse actually applies in context to part of the letter. I would suggest that our verse tonight, verse 6, may well be linked to chapter 5 of 1 Corinthians. Now, if you know chapter 5, it's hardly wedding material. Because Paul says there's a problem going on in your fellowship, and it's the problem of incest. A man is sleeping with his mother-in-law, and it ought not to happen. And he says, you are proud of it. You are boasting in it. You are rejoicing in evil, and it's wrong. You should be rather delighting in the truth. And that expression so fits what was happening in chapter 5, even to verse 2, where he says, you should be heartbroken and mourning, but instead you are proud of this situation. Now, why would Christians of all people be proud of incest taking place? A wrong sexual relationship between a mother-in-law and a son, or a stepmother and a son. Well, they were proud of it because they misunderstood what grace was all about. They misunderstood their freedom, their liberty in Christ. See, God's liberty, God's freedom is not a license to behave any way you like and you've got your ticket to heaven, no matter how you live. To think like that is to misunderstand what grace is all about. Now, what is grace? I like the definition of one person. Grace is everything for nothing to those who don't deserve anything. Grace is everything for nothing to those who don't deserve anything. True grace is when an individual realizes they have nothing to offer God but their sin. Just on Friday, we were telling the kids the story of the Pharisee and the tax collector who went up to the temple to pray. The Pharisee, of course, super religious. Prayed three times a day. He tithed, he fasted. He was disciplined in his study and his reading and his prayer time. But actually, he was showing off before others. What a good fellow I am. Coming to God in his own righteousness. And Jesus said he prayed with himself. Whereas the tax collector realized he was a sinful individual, full of faults and failings. He just bowed down before God. He humbled his heart. He beat upon his breast and he said, oh God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And he went away justified. Why? Because he experienced the grace of God. He had nothing to offer. But God in his goodness lifts up the humble but resists the proud. What is grace? Grace is when an individual says, God, I can't earn my salvation. Just yesterday, someone posted on Facebook a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. And the quote said this, and I emailed the person and said, oh, I'm going to use that tomorrow night in my sermon. Mahatma Gandhi acknowledged the inability of his religion to atone for his sins. Despite the fact he tried to live a lifestyle according to the Sermon on the Mount, a lifestyle of purity and holiness, he realized he was a sinful man and he had not found forgiveness. And he said this, it is a constant torture to me that I am still so far from him who I know to be my very life and being. I know it is my own wretchedness and wickedness that keeps me from him. There was a man who, through his own efforts, was trying to win approval of God. And he didn't find it. He didn't find it. His lifestyle would probably put many of us to shame. And do you know what the real tragedy for Gandhi is? He writes in his autobiography that one day, so impressed with the person of Jesus, having read the Gospels, he decided to go to a church. And when he turned up at the church, the man at the door said, "Sorry, we don't have your kind in here. Go and worship with your own type." And Gandhi writes these words: "If Christians have caste differences also, I might as well remain a Hindu." And he did. And not only did the church lose a great ambassador in world affairs, they lost a soul for Jesus. And throughout his life, all his goodness, all his good works didn't bring in the one thing he wanted: peace with God. Because that only comes through faith in Jesus Christ. That's grace. When, like the tax collector, we say, "God, I'm not trying to earn it. I don't deserve it. Have mercy on me." And these Corinthians had been saved from a terrible background. I'll mention in a minute how this is how Paul describes them earlier on in the letter. Chapter 6, verse 9. He says, "Some of you were wicked, thieves, greedy, drunkards, slanderers and swindlers, sexually immoral, idolatrous, adulterous and homosexual." Sounds like your everyday congregation in the UK, doesn't it? Actually, if we were effective in the gospel, it would do. Wicked, thieves, greedy, drunkards, slanderers, swindlers, sexually immoral, idolatrous, adulterous and homosexual. These were trophies of grace who had come to faith. But they misunderstood grace. They assumed that actually now they were forgiven, they could carry on living in some of those practices and be saved at the same time and still be right with God. They were abusing their grace. And Paul says, not only that, you are boasting in it. The more I sin, the more he forgives me. What a great God we've got. And do you know what? People still misunderstand grace. I was chatting to some Jehovah's Witnesses recently. And of course, they believe you can lose your salvation if you don't keep it up. It's kind of the death of Jesus and you top it up with good points, good behaviour. And I said to them, "No, we're saved by grace." And they said, no, you can't just be saved by grace. That means you can go and live any old how. And you say, no, that's not grace at all. That's an abuse of grace. You know, I don't go out and sin willfully, not because I'm trying to earn God's approval, but because I love him. The reason I don't go out and sleep with other women isn't because I'm trying to win points of merit with my wife. It's because I love my wife. I don't want to hurt her. And they can't see the difference between a relationship and just religious practice. And if you talk to a Muslim, they have exactly the same thing. They can't understand this concept of grace. What, God will forgive you just because he forgives? Yes. And then out of love, we seek a life to please him because we love him. And these Corinthians too had misunderstood grace. They assumed the more you sinned, the more he forgave. Hey, that's worth boasting about. And Paul says, no, love does not rejoice in evil. Instead of being proud of it, you should be ashamed of it. And the issue needs to be dealt with. It's as stupid as a man saying, "Do you know what? I crashed my car last week. I went to the hospital and they patched me up. Now next week I'm going to drive straight into a brick wall just again to prove how good the surgeon is at patching me up." You'd say, idiot. But if we're honest, how many of us do that spiritually? Deliberately, willfully doing things that we know will harm us. And we think, well, God forgives, that's what he's always done. They misuse grace and they boasted about how God forgave them. And Paul says, no, love does not rejoice in evil. So that's the first bit. We are to be displeased with the wrong things. But, oops, am I going the right way or the wrong way? And we are to be pleased about the right things, but rejoices with the truth. Rejoices with the truth. It's about vision and perspective, isn't it? Knowing what's right, knowing what's wrong. Someone wrote this little poem: "My face in the mirror isn't wrinkled or drawn. My house isn't dirty. The cobwebs have gone. My garden looks lovely, and so does my lawn. I think I might never put my glasses back on." See, when you put your glasses on, things come into focus, things come into vision, don't they? And when we examine our lives in the light of this book, we appreciate that there's a right way to live and a wrong way to live. And we are called to walk in the light the right way. I love what John Stott says. He says it about the letter of John, but the principle's the same. He says, to walk in the truth is more than to give assent to it. It means to apply in one's behaviour. He who walks in the truth is an integrated Christian, in whom there is no dichotomy between profession and practice. On the contrary, there is in him an exact correspondence between his creed and his conduct. Such conformity of life and truth on the part of his children brought the Apostle John greater joy than anything else. To him, truth mattered. But what is the truth we're to rejoice in? Well, I would suggest if we look at it again in the context, it's to do the things Paul corrected in this letter. Do you remember the Curley translation? Love does not delight in wrongdoing, but in rightdoing. And in almost every chapter of 1 Corinthians, there is wrongdoing and there is correction. This is what you should be doing. So if you look at the wrongdoing and do the opposite, you'll be rejoicing in the truth. We're walking in the truth. Now, let me just explain some of the errors that Paul corrected so that we can get a grasp of this. In chapter 1, verse 10 to 13, you had the problem of divisions in the church. That was error. That needed to be sorted. Also in chapter 1, you had the problem of worldly wisdom. That's chapter 1, verse 17 to chapter 2, verse 13. Thinking as the world thinks, not as God thinks. Evaluating situations from a human perspective. In chapter 3, you have the problem of carnality. Chapter 3, verse 1 to 4. In chapter 5, you have the problem of immorality in the church, as we mentioned. Chapter 5, verse 1 to 13. In chapter 6, you have the problem of one believer taking another believer to court, having court cases between Christians. Chapter 6, verse 1 to 8. The apostle said, this is wrong. In chapter 6, you also have the problem of fornication, the misuse of sex. Chapter 6, verse 15 to 20. In chapter 7, you have the problem of marriage and divorce. Chapter 7, verses 1 to 40, people were misusing. Chapter 8, you have the problem of meat offered to idols. Chapter 8, verse 1 to 13. In chapter 11, you have the problem of gender issues, the roles of men and women. Chapter 11, verse 1 to 17, the apostle has to deal with it. In chapter 11, you also have the problem of abusing the Lord's Supper. That's verses 20 to 34. In chapter 12, you've got the problem of misusing spiritual gifts. Chapter 12, verse 1 to 31. Here in chapter 13, you've got the problem there's a lack of love. So the apostle corrects it by showing us what love is. In chapter 14, again, you've got the problem of the misuse of the gift of tongues. And in chapter 15, you have the problem of wrong teaching about the resurrection of the dead. And even in chapter 16, there's a problem of the collection for the saints. People are getting it all wrong when it comes to giving to the fellowship. Now, I make that 15 problems that need correction. You probably could find a lot more in your studies. To rejoice in the truth is to live right according to God's revealed truth. And Paul says, you're living wrong in these 15 areas. Here's how to live right in these 15 areas. Don't rejoice in error. Don't delight in error. Don't set your heart on those things and then say, but God will forgive me. Set your heart on the corrective measures, the advice I give. Rejoice with the truth. Well, very quickly, I'm not going to go into all of them. Let me just mention those 15 things again. The problem of divisions in the church. Truth says seek after unity. That's rejoicing in the truth. When I turn up at church, I'm not part of the problem, I'm part of the solution. That's what it means, isn't it? I'm not there to divide, I'm there to bind people together. Someone gossips about someone, I'm going to say something positive about them. I'm going to redress the balance. Chapter 1. the problem of worldly wisdom. Truthful living is to be spiritually minded. We pray about things. We search the scriptures to get advice and information and principles and guidance over issues. We don't just say, well, everyone else is doing it, so it must be the right way. Chapter 3, the problem of carnality. Truthful living says, no, I'm going to follow the example and the attitude of Jesus. I'm not going to be jealous and quarrelling. I'm going to be loving and peaceable. Chapter 5, the problem of immorality. Truthful living says no. When it comes to relationships, my relationships are going to be marked by holiness and wholesomeness. Chapter 6, the problem of bringing other believers to court. Truthful living says no. I'm going to deal with issues one-to-one. And if we deal with the acorns, we won't have great big oak trees later on. So if there's an issue, deal with it early on, face-to-face. Maybe someone loses a bit of pride, but the issue gets dealt with. Chapter 6, the problem of fornication. Truthful living says, no, I will live according to God's revealed will. I will be pure. Chapter 7, the problem of marriage and divorce. Truthful living says, I will live according to God's guidelines. One man, one woman, together. And yes, at times relationships do break down. But with God's enabling and God's help, I will seek to be faithful in that area. Chapter 8, the problem of meats offered to idols. Truthful living says, I will keep a clear conscience before God. I won't bring idolatry in my life in whatever form if I can help it. Chapter 11, the problem of gender. No, truthful living says, I will realise God made women one way and men the other. They are equal but different. Chapter 11, the problem of abusing the Lord's Supper. Truthful living says, when I turn up at the Lord's Supper, I will examine my heart so that I can take part in a clear way. Chapter 12, the problem of misusing spiritual gifts. Truthful living says, I realise spiritual gifts are not weapons to fight with. They're not toys to play with. They are tools to build up with. And they're given to build each other up. Chapter 13, the problem of love. Truthful living says, I will recognise that above everything else, love is the glue that holds a church together. Chapter 14, the problem of misusing the gift of tongues. Truthful living says, no, gifts were given for the blessing of others, not just for personal pleasure. Chapter 15, the problem of wrong teaching. Truthful living says, I will study the scriptures to see what God says. And then finally, chapter 16, the problem of the collection of the saints. Truthful living will say, no, when God converted me, he converted my wallet as well. All I have is his. And so I will give proportionately. And each one gives proportionately what we've set aside in our hearts to the work of the Lord. So I've said all that to say what Paul summed up in two words. In conclusion, the verse is divided in two parts. A negative does not delight in evil. A positive rejoices in the truth. The Curley translation, if I can find it in my notes here. Don't focus on the wrong or sinful living. Focus on the right or holy living. Let's pray, shall we? And we'll conclude with our final hymn.